Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 236 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm here with two co-hosts. First is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Hi. Hello, our listeners out there. How's everything going? Our usual forecast would be cold, 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 but luckily we haven't had much snow recently. That's the purveyance of Max's universe. So happy here in Philly.
All right. Thanks, David. And also co-hosting, of course, is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening from Chicago, where it's beautiful, balmy, rainy, generally wintry kind of weather. And
our returning guest this episode is Henry Hartevelt. Now, Henry has been the chief research officer and co-founder of Atmosphere Research Group. That's a research and advisory firm. Before that, he was with Forrester Research, where Henry looked at the impact of technology on the world's travel industry. Henry, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
Now, I understand that you're actually getting ready to move on to another company.
That's correct. In December of 2012, I joined Hudson Crossing. Hudson Crossing is a New York-based strategic advisory firm to the travel industry. They work with travel agencies, airlines, hotels, travel technology companies, VC firms, and others. And I joined them as their industry analyst and to help start up a dedicated research practice. So basically taking what I was doing at Atmosphere and before that at Forrester and bringing it to the benefit of Hudson Crossing's clients.
Oh, that's fantastic. It sounds like it's going to be an exciting time to join something new. And it's not a new. How long has the company been around?
The company was founded in 2007. Ah. So is going to be 6 years old this year. And it is staffed with folks who are experienced in the industry. They come out of organizations such as Cendant, Travelport, TravelZoo, Virgin America, and other organizations. And it's great to be able to be with them. You know, they're smart, they're creative. They, like all of us, have this passion for the industry, and it's great to be able to be a part of it.
Did you have to move?
No, I remain based in San Francisco. And in fact, I've been, even when I was at Forrester, I began working at home. So the only thing that changed was the email contact in this case. So very low maintenance from that standpoint.
Fantastic. All right, good. Well, we're going to talk with Henry some more soon. First, though, we've got some aviation news to talk about from the past week. We've also got, I guess, David's aircraft of the week. David, are you being a little cagey on this this time? Are you going to tell us what we're going to hear about later?
Yeah, I'll tell you about it when we start to say it.
Okay. All right. We've also got Stephen Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast coming up with their Australia desk report. And, of course, Peter Johnson, our European contributor with his Across the Pond segment. We've also got some listener mail, and we've started to get a number of recorded stories. You'll recall that in the last few episodes, we've asked for folks to send in a little recording. First person, tell us about your involvement in aviation, your first flight, how you came to be involved in aviation. And we have several of those, so hopefully we'll get to some of them. All right, let's get started with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
I think we should go faster.
Yes. Our first topic is the merger. Of course, we've been talking about this every week, the merger between American Airlines and U.S. Airways, and the two companies have agreed to merge. It's not a done deal yet. There's a few more steps in the process, but it looks like it's going forward. We have an article from the New York Times, Service Cuts May Follow Merger of Airlines. And I guess there's a lot of speculation as to just exactly what the combined airline, which is to be called American, according to the press reports, and what the effect of that would be on the flying public. What do you guys think? Is this something that we're going to see some good, some bad, and something in between?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's just about any kind of an answer that works. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'll leap into this one. You know, look, airline mergers are tough. Anyone who's listening to this has seen them. In the past few years, we've seen America West and U.S. Airways merge, and that is not exactly a textbook case of a great merger. We saw Delta and Northwest merge. That does come close to a textbook case of a great merger. And then we had United and Continental merge, and again, textbook case of not a great merger. In terms of the execution, not what things look like on paper. Hmm. So, you know, I will say this. I think that the people at American and at U.S. Airways are keenly aware of the mistakes that have happened. American itself has been dogged by several mergers that have not gone well. And I don't think they're keen to repeat any mistakes they've made, let alone any of their competitors. Regarding the New York Times article, what I've noticed is that journalists in general love to focus on doom and gloom. You know, I think that when you take a look at the hubs and you take a look at the fact that there's minimal overlap, there are several dozen routes that probably could be opened up as a result of the merger. The combined airline, get this, with mainline and regional aircraft from all divisions, so American Airlines, American Eagle, U.S. Airways, and its two regional divisions, Piedmont and PSA, will have, get this, 1,533 airplanes, possibly a few more. Hmm. That's what they've got today. Now, some of those planes are going to go away. There are new planes coming behind them, but still, some of those planes may exit. You can do an awful lot to serve the traveling public and serve the traveling public well. But I think that as they take a look at this, some routes might be dropped because they simply just don't make sense. And at the same time, some routes may be added because they do make sense. A lot of obviously is going to depend on the state of the economy and the price of aviation fuel.
Hmm. Well, and then, of course, too, there is the beside the financial aspect of this, there's the employee side. How are the two pilot groups, the mechanic groups, the flight attendant groups, how is that going to work? And as Henry pointed out so nicely, the reason the merger seemed to go so smoothly with the Delta and Northwest options was that they did an awful lot of homework, you know, before the actual merger took place. And so they had lots of agreements. Now, of course, Henry, I'd be curious about your take on this, but, you know, U.S. Air spent an awful lot of time trying to get agreements between the unions at American and the unions at U.S. Air prior to this whole thing coming together. Do you think it has a good chance of working somewhat like the Delta merger, or would you call it maybe 50-50?
No, I think it's closer, its potential is closer to being like Delta Northwest. You know, the American unions are generally behind this, and they've been making headway in getting U.S. Airways, various unions, to sign on to contracts. And remember, the U.S. Airways employees, in many cases, will be going up to American Airlines wages. So that's going to be good for them. The merger seems to have the union's support behind it, and that is critically important in the airline industry. If you've got the union support as well as the employee's emotional support, that gives the airline a great strength, and hopefully it means that the execution will be that much better.
Henry, I saw over...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Max.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say I was in Boston this last weekend, and I ran into an American pilot in one of the terminals, and I asked about the merger, of course, and he said, "Well, you know, I think it's going to work. I think it's looking pretty good, actually." And then I said, "Well, that's for you guys with between you and U.S. Air." I said, "What do you think about the?" That leftover piece between U.S. Airways and America West, and he just kind of rolled his eyes. And I said, what does that mean? He said, end of discussion. So, you know, again, I don't know how much of the pilot or and or the flight attendant mechanic population that kind of attitude reflects. But I'm sure that is going to come back at some point and haunt a few folks.
You know, I think that there is more good out there than bad right now. Clearly, U.S. Airways needs to get the two sides of its labor house in order, what they call U.S. Air East, the legacy U.S. Airways employee work groups, and U.S. Airways West, the legacy America West work groups. But I think there is now a willingness to do this. And in fact, I think there is a very compelling reason for the employees to get this done because the American Airlines work group is much larger. There are seniority issues. There are, you know, which obviously then has implications in terms of promotion and aircraft that, at least especially for the pilots, that they will fly. You know, I think that there's going to be a lot of work to do. I think the mechanics groups are going to want to have the assurance that a certain amount of maintenance work will be done by the airline's combined maintenance workforce. And American, of course, has a very large and very capable workforce at bases like Tulsa and Kansas City and America West legacy operations in Phoenix and U.S. legacy operations in Philly and Charlotte. So there's a lot to do. You know, I think it's things like this that I use to point out to people that merging airlines is about a lot more than simply painting airplanes and changing the signs at a ticket counter and figuring out what brand of soda you're going to pour on the airplane.
Yeah, I think corporate culture is an important factor, too. And I think, Henry, you mentioned that in an NPR piece.
Yeah.
These cultures, they can be well integrated, or they can be cultures that, you know, cause difficulty.
You know, I've witnessed this a few times. You know, I was at TWA when we merged with Ozark, and even though we both had hubs in St. Louis, the cultures were very, very different. I was at Continental when we merged with People Express and New York Air. New York Air was a lot closer to Continental. It had been started by former Continental executives using ex-Texas International aircraft, but People Express, of course, was very, very different. You know, I look at Delta and Northwest, and I think that one of the things they did best was creating a culture that seems to have captured the best of the spirit of the two legacy airlines, but also something that is relevant and fresh for today's Delta Airlines. And I hope that as Doug Parker and his team work through the merger, that they are able to be as successful in creating the right culture for the new American Airlines. You know, America West is much more informal and much less hierarchical. And, you know, I think that is probably a better approach. But at the same time, American has excellent capabilities when it comes to analysis and detail and so on. You don't want to lose that because obviously this is an expensive merger. It's an $11 billion deal. So they have to find the right culture. And you know, what I hope they don't do is that they don't shove any one airline's culture down the other guy's throat. That just doesn't work at all.
No. See, and I think what Henry said is, I just wanted to kind of follow up on something. The selection of Doug Parker to run the place, I think, is the message that the people at American needed to hear about that change of culture, or perhaps a blending of cultures that says, you know, guys, we're gonna try this, and we're open to some new ideas, and you know, hang in there, because I think this is going to work. I mean, because I do think this is going to be successful. Probably more so than the United and Continental, maybe not quite as much as the Northwest.
Yeah, I mean, this has a lot of promise going for it. You know, remember, Doug Parker began his career at American Airlines. So in a sense, he is returning home and he understands what makes American Airlines tick. And but at the same time, he has been able to be with some very successful airlines that have made money, and focus on an operation that has been reliable, on time, all of the things that are essential to running a good airline. I think that he and his colleagues will be successful. I think they are determined to try to find a way to make it work, but it's not going to be easy. I think, in fact, this can be one of the most difficult challenges facing the senior leadership team of the combined American Airlines, because while it's not easy to blend res systems, it's not easy to figure out maintenance and MRO, it's not easy to figure out your network, there are at least processes you can take for that. Culture is truly organic, and it's so important in an airline industry, because if you think about it, airlines are tribes. You know, I mean, you hear people say, "Oh, I'm an American guy. I'm a Southwest guy. I'm, you know, a Virgin America person," whatever it is. Just like some people identify with Nike versus Reebok, people tend to identify with airlines, and the people who work for these airlines, you know, they're indoctrinated in a certain amount of culture. That's part of why they're hired to work for the airline, and it's part of what the airline does to sustain itself in terms of the service and consistency of delivery it gives the customer. You know, I think this is actually an exciting challenge for Mr. Parker, but wow, you know, of all of the things out there, I bet it's going to be one of the most vexing.
Now, the federal antitrust authorities still have to approve this merger, but no one really thinks that's going to be difficult.
Right. So the bankruptcy court in New York has to sign off on it. And I believe the hearing for that is scheduled for sometime in March. Then the Department of Justice and I believe DOT, Department of Transportation, also have to give it a review. And I'm like you, I can't expect that DOJ or DOT would find any reason not to approve this. They may ask for certain concessions at certain airports. For example, they may ask the combined airline to give up a small number of slots at Washington Reagan National or something like that to help bring in some more low-cost competition. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, again, with only 12 routes out of more than 900 overlapping, with no hubs overlapping, with the airline serving very different geographic regions, I just don't see how anyone could object to it. I mean, they've approved Delta Northwest. They've approved AirTrans Southwest. They've approved United Continental. I just don't think that there's a legal reason for them to object. Then again, I'm not a lawyer.
All right. Well, I think this is going to be pretty exciting. I mean, this is something that obviously has been on a lot of people's minds and the topic of a lot of conversation for quite a while now. It feels like we're coming down to the home stretch, and I guess after that, then the airlines can get on with the business of running airlines and flying passengers.
Hopefully they will focus on the business of making money, which means that we as travelers will have a more pleasant experience. It would be nice to see airlines make money. I'm not a Wall Street analyst, but I'm a business person. I'm an industry analyst. Without profits, you can't invest in the new aircraft. You can't keep the aircraft clean. You can't staff them the way you probably like to. You can't deliver the service the way customers would like. So let's hope this works. We're still going to have four very large airlines duking it out for the customer. Our research shows brand loyalty remains very, very low, with around 3 in 10 or so travelers saying they're brand loyal to any travel company. That means 70% of the traveling public's business is up for grabs, and even those people who are brand loyal probably have winnowed their loyalty down to a handful of airlines. You know, this remains a very, very tough business.
Yeah, that's interesting. What role do the fees play in all this? Are consumers savvy yet with regard to, you know, what the total cost, the total price of flying is going to be? Or is it still sort of a smokescreen of you know, a variety of different fees and different flavors that, you know, it makes it difficult for the public?
It does. I mean, travelers are very, very aware of their budgets. Again, our research shows that half of travelers allow their budgets to actually dictate where they go. So, you know, with the advent of fees and an uneven economy, travelers are very aware that fees are charged. I think they've all accepted the fact that this is the reality of flying in the second decade of the 21st century. I give credit to airlines, including American, along with Frontier and Air Canada, for creating products that have bundles in them. So if you want a fare that includes checked baggage or priority boarding or things like that, you can get it. The new regulations that the DOT imposed, which require airlines to show the fare all in, inclusive of taxes and fees and so on, I think helps the traveler. You know, optional products are just that. And I think the challenge is travelers want to make sure they can understand what the charges are, especially some of the basic things like checked baggage, so that they can budget accordingly and figure out what they should do. And that is important. And obviously airline websites and other places now have more and more content that help you do this. You know, I think people have accepted the fees. It's a part of it. They may not like it, but at least I give credit to airlines that are saying, okay, you may not like the fact that there are fees, but we are working on ways that can help you get the value you seek. For example, American actually has a fare you can trade up to that includes the price of checked baggage, priority boarding, and some other privileges. And the premium is a lot less than the cost of buying these things on a round-trip basis individually. So I think it's a fair deal for the customer. Let's hope that more airlines come out with these products. And frankly, let the customer shop based on value, not just price, but on-time performance, service, value for money paid, all of that.
Yeah, I think that would be better for all of us if flyers selected their airlines based on those things rather than just strictly on price. I mean, I think we've used the term, you know, the race to the bottom many times in terms of, you know, airlines trying to just compete solely based on price. And it doesn't produce a good experience for travelers.
Right. I mean, you know, and plus, airlines like Allegiant, Spirit, and Frontier have basically staked out that low price territory. You know, airlines like American, Delta, even Southwest are saying, we're going to compete on price. We're going to offer good, attractive prices, but they can't afford to go that low. And so maybe what we'll start to see in the airline industry is a little bit of stratification amongst the airlines. With maybe a few airlines emerging as, if you will, premium airlines based on a number of factors, including on-time performance and quality of service and amenities and comfort and those things, and some in the middle, and then some, obviously, Allegiant and Spirit, at the bottom, catering really to people for whom price matters first, second, third, fourth, you know, 99th in the top 100 things that they value. That's all to the good. I mean, that's what competition is about. It works in retail. It works in the hotel business. Works in a lot of other industries. Why shouldn't it work in the airlines?
Let's move on a little bit and talk about batteries, specifically lithium-ion batteries, which seem to be getting a pretty bad rap these days. We've seen that the issues with the 787.
Only if you try to put them in your airplane.
Yeah, then it's a
I'm sorry.
Then it's a problem, especially if you're Boeing. They really don't have a root cause yet, as we record this, for the 787 battery issues. Kind of the best they can come up with is that I think there's for either 6 or 8 cells in these lithium batteries, and one of them had a I don't know if meltdown is the right technical term, but had some issues, which then sort of cascaded to the other cells. And kind of the only solution that seems to be being offered, at least in the press right now, is to separate the cells so that, or to provide more insulation between them so that if one has a problem, it doesn't take out the whole battery. But the more interesting maybe development this week is that Airbus has decided that they are going to abandon the lithium-ion batteries on the A350 and instead go with a traditional nickel-cadmium, at least in the production aircraft. I think the test aircraft are going to continue on with the lithium-ion batteries. That's kind of an interesting development. I mean, I wonder if that's because Airbus has lost faith in the lithium-ion batteries, or if that's some other kind of a move, maybe even a marketing move.
I bet you they just don't want to take the risk. I mean, they've already watched the risk that Boeing took, and I just have a feeling maybe for right now they're saying, you know what, we don't need to go there.
Yeah, they kind of have the luxury, it would appear, of time. I mean, the A350 is marching along pretty quickly here, but they do have the time. Boeing, on the other hand, is kind of committed. I mean, if they were to say that, okay, we're going to go back to a nickel-cadmium battery, there's a whole recertification process that has to follow, and that's difficult. I think better to fix the problem.
Look, I'm not an engineer, so I should say this up front, but I will say Boeing is stuck between the rock and the hard place. No matter what they do, there's simply no easy solution. You know, they'd have to add, I think, fire suppression areas 787 in that aft compartment. If they redesign for nickel cad, they've got to, you know, again, as you pointed out, there's a whole bunch of not only the engineering work, but the certification. I would not want to be one of the people working on this project at Boeing, because I have a feeling they're not sleeping much or seeing their families at all right now. As far as the Airbus A350 goes, I think they're benefiting from Boeing's experience. I would argue that I don't think anyone at Airbus would say, you know, we're glad that it happened to them. No. They'd rather learn about this sooner rather than later. I think they will use nickel cad until lithium ion is once again viewed as safe and they figured out a way to work around these challenges. Boeing is a company of incredibly smart people, doesn't seem to have a plan B. And I'm not sure why that is, but it just takes me as surprise.
You know, can I add an interesting sidelight, I think, to this whole discussion, too, about the battery issue, is that this week the International Civil Aviation Organization put an exemption to an exemption, essentially, into place, because up until just a few days ago, the passenger airlines were allowed to carry these batteries from an aircraft like the 787 as cargo on passenger airplanes. And as everybody knows, they've been carrying batteries for they've been carrying our iPhones and our laptops and all that sort of thing. But they did have an exemption to carry batteries up to, I believe, 77 pounds. And it was specifically put in place initially so that if an airplane was stuck somewhere, they could throw a battery on there and just use the regular airlines to get a battery to the airplane. They'd be fine. And ICAO said, you know what, that's not a real smart idea. And so they put in place, again, a restriction that the airlines will no longer be able to carry these batteries because the risk is just simply too high.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, in some of the more technically oriented articles on this topic I've read, one thing that's come out that you don't generally see is that when you talk about lithium ion batteries, it's not just one specific battery. I mean, you can manufacture lithium ion batteries that have different kinds of, I don't know, call them chemicals or elements in them, and some are more unstable than others. So it's not just, you know, all lithium ion batteries, but the kind that Boeing had selected has got a, you know, very high energy density, which is great for reducing weight. But as at least someone pointed out somewhere, even if you cut the weight of the batteries in half by going to this technology, it's just a really small percentage of the total weight of the aircraft, and maybe not so significant. I know. How about the effect on the public? Are we seeing people, you know, start to behave differently, or you know, is the 787 Dreamliner starting to be called into question by the public?
You know, I'll just venture that what surprised me is Boeing did an amazing job in creating awareness among the public of the 787, and not just the 787, but the use of the term Dreamliner. Their marketing and public relations teams really did get that out there. And what I have heard from people who are not aviation geeks like us, they are now calling it the Nightmare Liner.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're aware of the problems that the airplane has. And, it, you know, frankly, it doesn't help that in some cases some of the challenges may have been blown out of proportion in terms of this, in relation, say, to the actual seriousness of the event. But what I have heard from people, again, anecdotally, is questions about how will I know the 787 is really safe when it goes back to into service? We haven't had a challenge like this with an airplane since the DC-10 was grounded in 1979. I will tell you that, again, based on experience, when I was working on Americans advertising in the early 1980s and working for TWA in the mid-1980s, there was a lot of negative backlash, a lot of concern about flying on the DC-10. And in fact, TWA even advertised that they flew L-1011s, which gave TWA a marketing advantage against airlines that were operating the DC-10. You know, I think a lot will depend, obviously, on the solution. But I would say that I think in this case, especially in the age where we are all connected, where there's social media as well as traditional media, that Boeing and the NTSB and the FAA and others will have to do as good a job of convincing the public that the 787 is safe to fly as they did when they were introducing the airplane all along. They need to reestablish its credibility. That said, everyone I know who has flown on a 787 has enjoyed it. They have spoken about the benefits, the larger windows, lower cabin altitude, higher humidity, feeling more relaxed. So those who have flown the plane, I think, frankly, will be some of its best advocates when it goes back into service.
Yeah, and Boeing probably has to wait until this issue is resolved before they can crank up the marketing of the public relations machine to reestablish that feeling amongst the public.
You're right, Max. I mean, they absolutely have to. I mean, you know, they've got to fix the problem first.
Right.
Yeah, and they don't know what they're fighting right now.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not really sure what the message would even be if they even if someone wanted to start trying to cover some of the wounds. I mean, there just is no way to do it.
Henry, I know that you have to run on to meet a client. So we just have a few minutes left with you. The one thing I wanted to ask, if we do have a few minutes, is I think the research, the industry analyst kind of job is one it's kind of interesting and I think maybe attractive to a great many people who might be looking towards a job in the industry. So my question is, if someone is kind of starting out in their career and wants to grow up to be a Henry Hardeveld, how should they do that?
Oh, dear God. So you know, I certainly grew up loving aviation. I worked in advertising and marketing positions at airlines, at a hotel company, the Fairmont Hotel Management Company, for a travel technology company, and a branding agency. So I have this mix of skills. And what I would say is that the role of analyst, industry analyst, is one where certainly you need good quantitative skills. I spend a lot of time running data and a lot of time, more time than I'd really like, looking at spreadsheets and making PowerPoint charts. But really, it is a great opportunity for someone who has a passion about whether it's the technology side, the marketing side, or something like that. And I think that's the most important thing. You've got to be passionate about this industry. And I think those of us who listen to this broadcast, you know, we are passionate. We live it. We breathe it more than some others in our lives would like, but we do nonetheless. And what I would say is that obviously get the skills you need, data, statistics, all of that. But it helps to work in a variety of roles. You know, if you want to work at a variety of companies, great. But, you know, again, that's really what makes my job so interesting, is I can sit in a meeting and then bring the perspective of what I have seen happen over time. So, you know, a lot of people get hired in as analysts. That's different than becoming an industry analyst, but it's not a bad start. But, you know, again, industry analyst is something I happen to fall into, and I was lucky. I love it, and it's working for me. That's all I can say.
All right. Well, I'm glad we had a chance to have a few minutes with you this week, Henry. We'll have to have you on again. We should have you on more frequently, I think, if you're agreeable.
It's always a pleasure. As long as your listeners don't object to my droning on, I'm happy to participate when I can add value.
All right, and good luck with Hudson Crossing. We'll look forward to watching that company.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
All right, well, we're back. We really want to thank Henry Hartevelt for joining us. He did have an engagement that he had to attend, and so we really want to thank him for, despite that, spending some time with us. I think he kind of cut it right to the bone there. But we do have a few more news stories we want to talk about, so we'll do that quickly. First one comes from the Air Force site, af.mil. This is Air Force increases projected KC-46 flying hours and crew ratio. So just when you thought there were no more tanker stories to be had, this is about the KC-46, which, of course, is the new U.S. Air Force tanker based on the Boeing 767. So they say, the Air Force says that they've increased the planned life cycle flying hours and air crews that are assigned to these tankers to make optimal use of the commercially proven aircraft's fuel efficiency, cargo, and aeromedical evacuation capabilities. So they're going to increase the number of air crews assigned, make some other changes. And this has an overall effect of adding about a little over 11% to the cost, of the long-term cost of this. David, I thought this was kind of interesting because it's kind of an example of how program costs can be estimated or planned at the beginning of a program, but things change along the way, don't they?
Oh, yeah. In my profession, we call that scope creep. What you initially come up with is a basic plan. And of course, Murphy says that there's going to be other things that you need to account for. In this case, it's to get more out of the airplane, they have to increase crews. They didn't have enough people planned or slated to go into the program to make the aircraft optimal. So they're backtracking and they're increasing the amount of crews so that they can get the most out of the airplane. So in a way, it's spending more money, but they're trying to get the most bang for the buck.
I think it's not always the contractor, the prime contractor that causes increases in the expense. And this is a case where, like you say, it's the Air Force has increased the scope and now all of a sudden there's an 11% bump. That's pretty significant,
Can I ask a question here? I'm not completely certain I understand what the issue is that we're talking about here. I mean, are we talking about simply the fact that the Air Force wants to use the airplane more often than it had originally planned?
Yes.
And hence needs more bodies?
Yes.
So how does that increase the cost? Well, it doesn't increase the cost as far as the manufacturer is concerned.
No, it doesn't, but we're talking about the program, not just the airframe.
So you're talking increased crews.
Air crews and
fuel.
With the increased crews and usage, you've got increased ground crews.
Maintenance.
You've got increased maintenance. The program is growing, not necessarily the airplane program.
Ah, I see. Okay, now I'm with you.
They're trying to get more bang for their buck.
Which costs 11.2% more bucks. But that's okay. I don't know what the process is.
Yeah, they're trying to get more bang for their more bucks. I mean...
That's right.
Now... Unfortunately, it's a matter of having to spend money in another area to optimize the original thing you bought. Does that make sense? You bought the KC-46, and then you realize, well, wait a minute. We're really not using it at its full potential. How do we fix that? Well, we need 60 more new crews. So we're adding money to this portion of the program to benefit and get optimization out of the other part of the program.
And it's adding how much to the kitty?
11.2%.
I'm sorry. I meant in terms of dollars. Do we know what that amount is?
The total program is $103 billion.
So
it's about
adding,
$1 billion, right?
Yeah, about $1 billion more.
No, not if it's 11%.
Well,
you said 11%.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's over $10 billion. If it's $110 billion.
Yes. Yeah, you're right.
You're right.
Sorry.
So I guess I'm just trying to understand how it could be that expensive to train 65 more crews for this airplane.
It was 65 more crews over the life of the airframe. Suddenly the light bulbs comes on.
Well, I didn't hear life. I missed that part. And what do they figure the life of this airplane is?
50 to 100 years.
50. So they think they have another B-52 on their hands. So.
Yeah, well, we have KC-135s that are over 50 years old.
No, obviously they don't build them like they used to. Don't you think Boeing's sitting there saying, boy, am I glad we didn't make that 787 the tanker?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But who know? But you don't know, the 767 might have been getting lithium ion batteries.
Yeah, don't know.
There's a hell of a lot more electrical parts in a tanker than there are in an airliner.
Yeah, good
like
point.
Like booms and drogues and pumps for tanks. So, you know, you never know what additional batteries are going into the tanker.
Yep.
That aren't now.
Yeah, lots of electricity around a lot of gas. There's a place I want to be. Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Last story. This is from the Duluth News Tribune. Cirrus hiring ramps up for new light personal jet. Now, Cirrus, this is about the Vision jet. Rob and they're on a hiring spree as this jet moves along. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that everybody was kind of disappointed last year when Cirrus was purchased by the Chinese consortium. But of course, what you're seeing now is a bit of the fruit of that partnership. I'm sorry, that's the word I was struggling for that ownership role, I should say. And that is the fact that the Chinese are willing to put money into the Vision Jet program that the Cirrus factory on its own was probably not going to be able to complete. And I think the fact that they've ramped up the hiring in the last few months in Duluth says, hey, we're going for it, baby.
Hmm. Yeah, the article says the Chinese invested almost $100 million in this jet. This is a very light jet.
Correct. And, of course, they don't actually use that term very light jet anymore.
They don't?
That's very
I like
out
that
of
term.
Favor.
Oh.
Yes. Well, I always thought it was kind of nice. I mean, it's in the same category as the Eclipse. And, of course, right. Except that the Eclipse is a two-engine airplane, and the Vision Jet is going to be a single-engine jet. But having sat in the cabin of the prototype, it's a nice roomy little airplane on the inside. And I think that one of the benefits of Cirrus doing this is that they have not forgotten the construction concepts they used to build the original Cirrus piston engine airplanes, which was the fact that they are roomy and that people like being comfortable, and they like an airplane that is easy to climb into and out of. And the Vision Jet will be that if it continues to move along the construction lines of the prototype.
So if we don't call these very light jets anymore, what do we call them?
Itty-bitty jets.
Itty-bitty
sort of
jets?
Light
That's
jets?
My new. Itty-bitties, yeah. Little babies.
Well, I see in the article, they talk baby jets. Richard Abalafia has something to say about this. And Richard, of course, is always very insightful when it comes to such things. He says that the company that, and this is not a quote, it's just how it's described in the article, that the company that first fills a niche in the low end of the light jet market will have an advantage, especially if it doesn't have competition. He says he doubts the market's big enough for two companies in this range. Hmm.
Well, sure. And of course, last year, Piper actually, was that last year, beginning of last year or the year before, when Piper pulled out and decided they were not going to build their single engine jet, that pretty much left the marketplace open to the Vision Jet. But then, of course, when Cirrus ran into financial issues, even that looked like it was going to go away. But now you're going to have all these turbine-powered airplanes coming into the marketplace. I mean, we have the Pilatus, we have the TBM, the Kestrel. In fact, we're going to have Alan Klatmeyer from Kestrel on next week to talk about that. And so we have all these turbine-powered airplanes, but the again, the Vision Jet is the only single-engine pure jet, and that is going to be, you know, we just have to kind of wait and see how that works out in terms of the performance, because the initial discussions said that they were not going to make these airplanes RVSM qualified, which is the reduced vertical separation minimums that would allow them to fly above flight level 290. So the engines won't be quite at their best altitude. So, you know, it's going to remain to be seen here, I think, as to whether we will get the peak performance that they're looking for on some of these single-engine jets.
Now, these things are not terribly inexpensive, but they do have a lot of orders. The article says that orders for the Vision Jet are at 525, which at $2 million a pop, that's a pretty good revenue stream on its way to Cirrus.
Well, of course, the Eclipse folks had orders for more than 1,000 airplanes at one point before they went bankrupt. So I don't know. I think you always have to be careful about putting too much credibility into simply orders for small airplanes. It's not quite the same as say, people signing on to the A320 Neo or something like that with a huge deposit.
And now, with his aircraft of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week. We interrupt this segment due to the U.S. sequestration effective March 1st. Let me first say that I'm evoking the "it's my segment and I'll write what I want to" clause.
We get that a lot lately, you know.
I also want to say up front that these are my own opinions and those not of Max or Rob's. Haven't heard this up until just now. Sequestration is defined by the freedictionary.com as 1. The act of sequestering or segregation. 2. In chemistry, the inhibition or prevention of normal ion behavior by combustion added materials, especially prevention of metallic ion precipitation from solution by a formation of coordination compound and phosphates. Or 3, it's a law, seizure of property, or a writ authorizing seizure of property. It's the last definition I want to discuss tonight. For our overseas listeners, I apologize for a U.S.-centric opinion piece which might cause their eyes to glaze over. But after kicking the can for a little less than 60 days, the U.S. Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, are going to push us over the brink. On March 1st, a series of drastic cuts will occur. $85 billion must occur. The majority of this is military spending, however, it will affect all aspects of aviation. The United States Air Force programs, the F-35, the AC-130J, the KC-46A, and the MQ-9 Reaper programs will have reductions in buys. So to save money, we will have to spend more per aircraft. Does that make sense? Lastly, Thursday, the United States Air Force, in preparation for the cuts, have canceled the following United States Air Force open houses: Dover, Langley, Seymour Johnson, and Luke. Quote, "I cannot in good conscience spend some of our limited resources to host an open house while the Defense Department considers potential civilian furloughs," said Brigadier General Michael Rostein of the 56th Fighter Wing, commander at Luke. "The Air Force has to consider the fiscal challenges affecting the Department of Defense and the nation," said Colonel Corvin Alk of the 633rd Base Wing at Langley. "We're taking prudent steps now in order to be good students of the taxpayer resources while focusing on maintaining readiness." Sequestration will effectively ground the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds. Some have said that those teams are unnecessary expenditures of the military. So the United States Air Force have decided that expenditure of an open house is the easiest thing to cut. So what are we losing by that? In simplest terms, not being able to see our tax dollars and work up close and personal. Open houses or air shows, when they are where we can see the best the U.S. has to offer, the United States military. Every base, as always, has a contingent from that state's National or Air National Guard. Those are the people who are always on the front lines of natural disasters, rescuing people off roofs by helicopters, searching for survivors in blizzards. They are there when we need them the most. This year, we'll lose the opportunity to thank those men and women in person. Air shows are the greatest recruiting tool. This year, some girl might miss out on seeing Major Carolyn Jensen, Thunderbird number 3, and the opportunity to look at her and say, I really want to do that. Ask anyone on the jet teams and they will always say, I wanted to learn to fly because I saw the Blues or the Birds when I was a child. While that young girl may never get to see the Thunderbirds, she might still get her ticket. But that's not only the military affected, so is the FAA. $483 million will be immediately removed from the FAA's budget. That will involve furloughs of controllers, safety personnel, and clerical workers. Imagine how long it's going to take you to renew your license now. There might not be anyone available to inspect the new batteries on the 787s. Programs like NextGen will be on hold indefinitely. Not to be an alarmist, but what will ATC furloughs mean to our national air traffic control? AIA's Marion Blakely said in August, a worst-case scenario, including possible closures of 246 airport control towers, 1,500 fewer air traffic controllers, and the loss of 9,000 security screeners and 1,600 customs officers. For GA pilots, this will affect their ability to fly when they want and how they want. Well, we've talked about military and general aviation, but oh, you airline geeks, you're not spared either. Blakely continues, it will certainly be a drag on the airlines, which then will incur great cost, which then will be passed on to the consumer, or it will be cut into the carrier's very meager profits, and that's not healthy for the airline industry. The TSA might have to cut as much as 9,000 screeners. I know some of you are right now cheering the thought, but take a moment of what I said and think. I said it will take 9,000 screeners away, not screening. Tripling the line lengths. How long will furloughed employees take the Department of Justice to approve the American-USA merger? Not to mention the day-to-day safety checks done by the FAA, causing the aircraft to remain grounded and causing delays in the U.S. aerospace infrastructure. So all of this is happening this week while Congress takes a week off. We take for a great deal of granted here in the United States. These issues are serious. We all personally have to balance our budgets. Why can't our legislators? I know I have focused on aviation themes, but more seriously will be the thousands of people who will be furloughed, possibly 800,000 in the Department of Defense alone. When you lose your job, even temporarily, it costs everyone. For the defense companies, there will be a huge outflow of people becoming unemployed. For our military families who don't get paid enough for the service they provide us, for all of us, it'll involve hardship. Somewhere, somehow, someone will step up to the plate and maybe we'll get this ship turned around. Sequestration will affect every one of us. I urge all of our listeners to call, write, and email your representatives to tell them to get off their asses and do something. We Americans deserve better from the people we voted into office. Let them know we don't want our aviation stolen from us. I mean, sequestered. Rant done. I'm stepping off my soapbox. We return you to your regularly scheduled feature. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geek's angry historian, signing off.
And now, with a counterpoint, is Robert Mark.
Well, no. I wish I could say there was something that I disagreed with David on there, but there certainly is not. I think the only thing that's really that really is even sadder than this editorial that David just did is the fact that the Congress brought this on themselves. This was not some sort of a spending issue that just kind of appeared one day. They looked each other squarely in the eyes and said, we are going to change our ways, and we both know it, meaning Republicans and Democrats, we both know it so well. We are so committed that we're willing to stick our necks out in a noose like this, knowing that it'll never happen.
Yeah, but well, they weren't sticking their necks out. They were sticking out the rest of ours.
That's exactly right. And I'm sorry. If we're going to have a rebuttal, my rebuttal's easy. I'm sorry. We ought to have term limits for members of Congress. And if we had term limits and they weren't so busy trying to get reelected like the president can only do once in his term, I think we might see people being a little less risk averse because they wouldn't have to worry so much about how every damn decision they make affects the voters back in the homeland. And now everybody is worried from day one about everything they do and whether they're going to get reelected to their 17th term in Congress or some damn thing.
So, I mean, it really, I have never, ever, ever, other than the year that we closed down the government by the where I couldn't go to the Air Force Museum, the scope of this, for our listeners, it affects museums, it affects air shows, for all of those NASCAR fans that we have, bye-bye flyovers.
You know, we do have another option.
And that is?
We could all move to Australia. Oh, speaking of which, this week on the Australia desk...
Great segue, Max.
All right, let's see what Ben Ippolito has to say on the Australia desk. You remember Ben, ATC Ben?
Oh, yes.
My buddy.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia news desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 18th of February, 2013.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 236. Well, Grant, I tell you what, it's been a pretty quiet week here in aviation. We've got a few quick stories to run through here. And
I don't know, man. It hasn't been that quiet, has it? I mean, you know, Qantas tells the ACCC to go shove it when the ACCC asks them to print a redacted version of their master coordination agreement with Emirates. That's pretty big.
Yeah. But I think we've covered that story enough the last few weeks. So what about this one? The RAAF returns its British Aerospace Hawks to the air. I didn't even know they were grounded.
Yeah, what? They were grounded? Wait a minute. We didn't really notice down here.
When did that happen?
Oh, wait, probably about the same time that Finnair decided they'd start flying back to Australia. Sort of, kind of. But, you know, maybe everyone's starting to play the Monty Python song, you know, Finland, Finland, Finland.
Yeah, that's true. Well, here's another one. Garuda Indonesia introduces Jakarta to Perth. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, we sort of mentioned that last time when we were saying that they were trying to gear up to be able to do their competition to the Kangaroo route and go to London via Jakarta. That's what they're seeming to be building to.
Yeah, well, I think we might cover that because, to be honest with you, folks, we're right in the middle of our preparations for the Australian International Air Show series, and we haven't had a lot of time to prep for this one. But I tell you what, one article that did come across our desk concerns air traffic control, and we know if we talk about that, even Rob won't complain. So
we might be able to go for 2 hours.
That's right. So helping us out with that is our resident air traffic controller here at Plane Crazy Down Under, ATC Ben. How are you, Ben?
I'm good, folks. I did come across this one the other day, so I thought I'd try and sneak it in there and get myself a gig on the Oz desk while I'm at it.
Okay, so this article here is in australianaviation.com.au, and it says Lockheed Martin proposes ATM platform for Australia. So I'm assuming that means they're going to put automatic teller machines in all the air traffic control centres. Is that right?
No, it's actually the air traffic management platform. We have a program at the moment called OneSky, where we're trying to replace the air traffic management systems that are used both in the civil and the military environment, because at the moment SLs at air services, we use one system, and the Australian Defence Force uses a completely separate system. The idea going forward is to both of us use the same system, so then of course you've got a lot of synergies and things that come forward from that.
Well, that sort of links up with everything we've been talking about over the last few years about tighter integration between defence and civil, and opening military airspace and having military controllers do more civilian stuff on those combined operation bases, things like that. Is that it?
That's right. So this is going to be the software system that those of us on the front line are going to get to use every day of the week. And Lockheed Martin has put their hand up and said, well, they're going to use their Skyline Enterprise platform as their bid for the program. It's going to go out to tender later this year. So it's going to be an interesting Avalon, I believe, because Lockmart said they're going to bring their platform to Avalon, and I dare say all the other players will too.
Oh, it sounds like we know what Ben's going to be doing when he's on the team at Avalon.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Looks like you'll be quite busy with a lot of interviews there, mate.
Sounds like it.
Now, of course, so the interesting thing here, of course, is that it also has to be compatible with ADS-B, which is obviously, it's already in use here in Australia in a limited fashion, but we know that they want to expand its use over time. So obviously any new technology that comes in here is going to have to be compatible with that.
That's right. It has to be completely backwards compatible with what we have now, with a variation of different kinds of radars and the ADS-B technology. And then, yes, moving forward, it's going to become all ADS-B over time, I would imagine, except for maybe the approach areas and things like that. But ADS-B is going to become the primary technology as we keep moving forward.
Now, Australia uses a derivation of the Eurocat system. Is that right, currently?
That's right. We use the Australian Advanced Air Traffic System.
TATS.
Shortened down to TATS. Because we love an acronym in aviation.
Absolutely.
So what's one more between friends?
That's right. So would the idea be that this system would sort of come in and overlay over the top of the current two systems, or is this the idea is to replace both current systems with this one?
No, this is One Sky Australia is going to be a complete replacement of TATS for the civil side, and I believe the military system is called ADATS, which is about 2 years older than TATS itself. There's just the two different systems that they use. The civil system is a Eurocat-based platform, which is done by Thales, which is a French company. And ADATS, I believe, is based on a Raytheon platform. So, but going to the combined one, it should allow a lot more synergies, especially when you get to places like Sydney and just north of Sydney, where they interface with Williamtown, and also in Perth, where you've got Pierce, which is just to the north of the Perth International Airport, thereby about 10 miles north.
Plus in Adelaide, where you've got Edinburgh, Darwin, which is a combined operation, and Canberra, where you have the RAF base on the side of it. So quite a bit of areas where they can overlap, hey?
That's right. So the theory then being that the Air Force and the civil side will share the same picture, and the Air Force is obviously going to be able to see different bits and pieces that are going to be unique to their system that we're not going to get to see, which is all security and all that sort of thing based. And we obviously don't need to know about all their secret squirrel stuff, but we will be able to see a common picture. So it might further down the line allow for things like letting a medical aircraft straight through a restricted area without having to deactivate the restricted area in the first place and things like that.
Yeah, well, it's basically allowing you an air traffic control picture, but not a tactical layout of a potential battle space, I guess, is what they'd be doing there.
Yeah, that's right. So they're in a tactical sense, they'd be looking at it more as a battle space sort of picture, and they have different things, obviously, that they record on. You know, yep. I don't really care, you know, how many missiles a FA-18's got left or whatever they can see on their screen about their different targets and what they keep track of. But obviously the military side of it is of no use to me in my job. I just need to know, you know, where it wants to go and how fast and what level.
So One Sky becomes the one true system to, in the darkness, bind them.
That's right.
Oh, dear. You've been waiting for weeks to use that, Grant, I'm sure. Well, that sounds good. And, surprisingly, that actually makes a lot of sense to me. If they bring any system that does this sort of thing in, I think it would be a good idea. So I guess we'll be in for some interesting and exciting times in the world of air traffic control here in Australia over the coming years.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting thing to see what system is actually selected and what it's actually going to look like to the end user.
And how it gets deployed. Oh, that's always a wonderful thing in a live operation like air traffic control.
Yeah, so that might be a very interesting thing, but we've got a few years to go before we get to that. They're at this stage talking the end of the decade, I believe.
Well, mate, it certainly sounds like you're living in interesting times.
Well, folks, of course, Ben can talk to us all night about air traffic control, and if you'd like to know more about how air traffic control works here in Australia, you can always send an email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, or you can fire one over here to us, planecrazydownunder@gmail.com, and just write question for Ben, and we'll send it on to him. We like giving Ben lots of work, don't we, Grant?
Oh, totally. It's great, because it means that you're not giving me work.
Yeah, that's right, and speaking of the Australian International Air Show, as we were just before, and speaking of generating work for lots of us, next week as we record, it'll be the day before the air show starts. And we'll be down there for all 6 days of that air show. We're taking a team of seven this year, and we've even rented a house out that side of town, so we're going to have a great old time. I don't know whether we'll get much work done, but we'll have a great time.
Party. I mean, sorry, work hard, yes.
There you go. And folks, if you haven't caught up with our show, Plane Crazy Down Under, for a while, well, episode 100 has just been released, and we'd invite you to come and have a listen to our show. 100 episodes has taken a lot of work. It's taken us about 4 and a bit years to get there. We don't produce shows quite as efficiently as Max does, but we got there in the end.
Yeah, it takes us a little bit longer. I think it's because we're still using clay tablets for some things.
That's it. Well, this is Australian internet. Everything works slower here.
Mostly. Anyhow.
So that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Until next week, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
I'm ATC Ben.
Cheers, folks. We'll see you next week at Avalon.
All right. Well, you know, it's always great to hear from ATC Ben. Hopefully, we'll hear more from him in the future. You know, those guys are working on their episode 100, the big one. So I'm pretty excited to who knows what those guys are going to do.
My guess is they're probably going to make some kind of a cheap shot comment about how close that is to my age. If I know those.
That's
those
a good idea.
Kangaroo killers down there.
I'll have to.
But I don't want to give them any ideas. Actually, okay. Let me run an idea by you that I do think our listeners will find interesting. Because as we're recording this tonight, a new site from Boeing just went live, and it's essentially a 787 update site. And the URL is 787. It's the numbers 787 updates. newairplane.com, and we'll put that in the show notes. But essentially, it's Boeing taking a look at everything that's going on with the 787. The number 787 updates, plural, 787 updates.newairplane.com.
Oh, cool. All right, I'll check that out. All right, here's Peter Johnson across the pond. Peter is taking a visit to the world's largest dedicated helicopter museum. Sounds cool. Here's Peter.
Today, we welcome Elvan Atreis to the program to talk about the world's largest dedicated helicopter museum. Elvan, welcome to Across the Pond.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us. Elvan, can you tell us a little bit about why the helicopter museum exists?
Well, I always give people a health warning. Don't start collecting things. Because it actually started when I started collecting helicopter memorabilia and then my first helicopter in 69. And to cut a long story short, I carried on collecting helicopters. We then turned the collection into a registered charity. Yeah. And the museum started collecting helicopters itself. And we now have over 80 aircraft, plus a lot of memorabilia and other stuff, all to do with rotary wing.
Yeah. And you're an active helicopter pilot. You're still flying. What's the appeal of the rotary wing versus the fixed wing?
Far more freedom, I would say. You're far less restricted than you are with fixed wing operations.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's just far more fun.
Yeah. And the museum's now a very active museum. What sort of areas do you cover? What sort of items do you have in the museum?
It's a worldwide collection, Russian, American, all kinds of helicopters. What we tried to do is look at all the different kinds of technology. So twin rotors, yeah. Coaxial rotors, all sorts of things like that. And also look at, if you like, the social history. So we have, for example, two helicopters that served in the Vietnam War with the US Army. We have Russian helicopters like the Hind attack helicopter, yeah. Which is very representative of the old Cold War Soviet Union, offshore oil helicopters, a whole range of that, and going right back to the very earliest. I mean, the oldest helicopter we have was built in 1931, okay. Which is actually before the first successful helicopter flights.
Yeah. You've got both archives and you have historical airframes. Why do you feel the need to preserve these items?
In a way, no one else was doing it, certainly in this country. You know, we had the Royal Air Force and the Fleet Air Arm Museum, who were only interested in the helicopters that they operated. No one was looking at the experimental helicopters, the civil helicopters. And so, in a way, if you like, there was a gap, which we fill. And that's still true today. I mean, there are very few dedicated helicopter museums around the world. There's only three.
Right, okay. Where are the other ones, just as a matter of interest?
There's one in Germany, which is very restricted because it's actually in a converted house in the middle of a town. And then there's the American Helicopter Museum in Philadelphia, which is only collecting American helicopters. So, you know, we are the only international collection.
Wow, and it is quite a spectacular collection of all types of airframes. What are some of your, I suppose, more interesting, or what are your favourites within the collection?
Well, I suppose I have to say the Hind, because it's an incredible beast. And again, when you start examining it and looking at it carefully, you can see how it was designed to defend the Russian steppes and so on. Very different character to our own requirements, which were to defend the forests, if you like. So it's a heavily armoured helicopter to fight in the open air. That's certainly one, I suppose. The other one must be the Tandem Rotor Belvedere, which was built here at Western Supermare, and which I was involved with as a young lad, you know, when I worked at the company. And again, that's pretty rare.
And how do you get hold of some of these airframes? Because you've described two there, very different airframes, but not the easiest to get your hands on.
You could almost write a book about how we've acquired all these aircraft. My first job, if you like, is to find the aircraft and get them for the museum.
Yeah.
So the first approach is to scrounge.
And for our international listeners, that's beg, steal or borrow.
Well, beg or borrow. Well, beg. We try not to borrow, and we certainly don't steal. If that fails, then obviously, you know, we have to look at forking out some money. And that depends on the rareness and the availability of the of the aircraft. Fortunately, in my day job, if you like, which is publishing helicopter magazines, I have very good contacts with the industry, and we've had good support from the manufacturers. In several instances, they've actually helped or donated aircraft to the museum. So, you know, and we have to thank companies like Eurocopter and Augusta Westland for that, and Boeing as well. You know, they've all helped us to acquire helicopters on display.
Okay, and coming down to the museum, hopefully the sun will come out at some time. All of the airframes are undercover?
Yes, the main collection is all undercover, and you know, associated with that, we do have a restoration conservation workshop where the public can watch the aircraft being restored by volunteers. We are very volunteer based, incidentally.
Okay, and if somebody wants to either come down and visit or get involved in some way, how do they go about doing that?
Well, visiting is easy. You know, we have a website, and just put in the helicopter museum and it will come up. We're well situated for people visiting. The museum is open every week throughout the year. And if people come and are interested in actually helping, whether it's in the archive or in restoration or in the shop even, then they just talk to somebody when they get there.
Okay.
We're a very friendly bunch.
And it's also on an active helipad as well, and you can actually fly from the museum as part of your entry ticket.
Not as part of the entry ticket per se, but yes, we do regular pleasure flights from the museum, and visitors do have the opportunity to see other helicopters coming and going. We get quite a lot of military helicopters flying in, and obviously visitors who fly in by helicopter. Plus, we also have, I keep a helicopter there that's airworthy, which we take out and fly. So, you know, yes, I mean, it's a very active museum.
So where can we find the website online?
Easy. It's whiskey.helicoptermuseum.co.uk. And if you go on that, it will also give you, you know, other addresses, because we do a blog and so on that people can follow the progress.
And we'll put links to the website, your Twitter address, and the blog in the show notes. We'd love to come back and do a special episode on the Helicopter Museum.
No problem. Very welcome.
Elvin, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Okay, thanks, Peter. David, I didn't know there was a helicopter museum. Yeah.
There is. The American Helicopter Museum is about 15 minutes away from me.
Oh, I'm sure you've been there.
Yep. Actually, when Adam Fast from Open Airplane came and visited us for the weekend, we actually went out to the museum and got to see Santa Claus tool around from a helicopter. But they have a B-22. They have my favorite helicopter, which is they have a MH-6 Little Bird that actually flew in combat in Somalia. Hmm. They have Hueys, they have Sea Sprite. It's a very nice collection, and being from pretty much, other than Sikorsky, the helicopter capital of the world, with Bell and Piasecki and Boeing in the area, they get a lot of neat stuff to look at.
Cool. Very cool. All right. Hey, let's move on to some listener mail. We got a lot of really interesting and fun listener mail. We heard first from a listener in the Netherlands. And boy, my pronunciation might be tough, but I think it's sort of like sweared. And he writes, I'm listening to your great podcast now since the episode where Alan Epstein comes over to discuss about the geared turbofan. It's such an amazing experience to find an airplane-related podcast. I'm totally new to that. And then he says, anyway, I kind of have a request. He says, could the GP7200 engine of Engine Alliance be part of a discussion? And what exactly went wrong with it in the Emirates flight from Sydney? News is vague about this issue, and it seems a struggle to get to the root cause. Please continue with your awesome podcast. So thanks, Sweared. Yeah, you know, this was interesting because it was kind of a big event, but there really was very little mainstream press coverage of this. And this was concerning an Emirates A380 that experienced an in-flight shutdown from this Engine Alliance GP7200 engine. And there is a pretty good Aviation Week article about this. We'll put the link in the show notes. But essentially, the problem seems to be have been caused by some insufficient cooling in some second stage high pressure turbine nozzles. And as a result of the insufficient cooling, we guess we had some part failures. And the FAA says that this engine shutdown and turbine case burn through was preceded by exceedance of the EGT, engine exhaust gas temperature limit, and loss of engine oil. So cooling is actually a big deal when it comes to turbine engines, because they, as you might guess, are very, very hot inside. And the parts have to be cooled either by ceramic or other kinds of special coatings, or by cooling holes. There's a variety of different methods that are used. And apparently the EA didn't quite get this right. So there's a airworthiness directive, a directive from the FAA. And this is kind of typical too when there's problems. So under this directive, the operators have to engage in a repetitive check on these specific parts. with a installation of new parts. I don't know if you'd call them redesigned, but changed parts at the next shop visit. Engineering changes like this, maybe not quite so dramatic, happen all the time. Parts are continuously being upgraded, updated, incorporating design changes as improvements to durability or other factors are discovered. And airlines and the maintenance companies providing maintenance have a certain amount of discretion in terms of which changes they implement in their engines or in their aircraft. But from time to time, when something serious like this comes up, the FAA mandates, and that's called an airworthiness directive, and the operators have to conform to the requirements of the directive. So that's kind of the story on that engine. But as Swearid says, it's kind of a big event, but I don't know, it didn't get a lot of press. I don't know if you guys saw it at all.
I must admit, I didn't.
Yeah, so...
when did it happen?
This was last year, late last year, late in 2012. I don't recall the exact month, but some time ago. So, interesting. All right, we got an email from Andy. Andy's from the UK. He says he's been listening for about 2 years. He says, I loved the fast jet stuff from the latest episode. And he sends along links to two videos on YouTube. One is Lowest Flyby Ever, Argentinian FMA, is that 1A63? IA63? David, I don't know that aircraft. And the other is Fighter Planes Incredible Flyby Caught on Camera. These are two videos of incredibly low, incredibly fast flybys. I don't know if you guys got a chance to take a look at these, but they're pretty impressive. They look kind of crazy.
Yeah, these are even better than that Yahoo out in the West or down in Texas, I should say, a couple of weeks ago that we had in the in the pits that almost ran the guy over with the camera.
Yeah, these are pretty incredible. So we'll put those links in the show notes. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we've been getting some listener recordings, great recordings from you all, first-person recordings about your experiences in learning how to fly or getting involved in aviation. And we got one from Tom Brucehaver, and he calls this It Takes a Village. So we'll let Tom tell his story.
I am very lucky. I had the opportunity recently to fly a pretty new CAE Boeing 737-800 simulator. It was a reward for a project that I and a few of my colleagues got worked on for an airline. It was really exciting, feeling just like the real airplane. I may never fly left seat in a real 737, but having 20 minutes in the left seat of one of these simulators is the next best things. I knew that I was going to get the simulator experience, so I brought my logbook. After the ride, I went to lunch and debated whether or not I should log it. As I thumbed through the logbook, I remembered the experiences I've had. I thought about my first flight and how I felt the sensory overload, all the concepts I thought I could grasp that were just missing. My instructor told me to turn to the south, and after looking at the instruments and out the window, I didn't know which way was south. He eventually told me to turn right, and I was able to handle that. A few months later, his confidence improved with me, and one day he got out of the airplane and told me to make 3 landings. That day was my first solo. I've always been interested in flying. When I was a kid, I grew up next to a guy who was a pilot. And his kids, my friends, told me about their adventures. I was able to live vicariously through them. When I was in high school, I had friends who had their pilot's license, and I was able to get rides with them. Eventually, I was able to fly PC flight simulators. I had friends offer me tips to fly the simulators. I read all the books and still thought it would be great to fly for real. At the time, I had a boss who was a commercial pilot. He took several of us to a trade show in Chicago. He owned his own Piper Seneca that he would fly charters in. He flew five of his employees to Meigs Field. I got to ride in the right seat. And he did his best to explain what was happening with all the ATC chatter and actual flying. I was scared. I turned him down. I still wanted to fly, but I couldn't afford it for many years. Eventually, I decided to try ground school. There's no commitment in taking ground school. It didn't cost much, and I could get something out of it. One of the students in the ground school went to an FBO and found out they had an intro flight for only $40. I could afford $40. I took the intro flight, and I was hooked. During my lessons, there were always the airport bums hanging around, willing to talk and offer their encouragement. I eventually got pretty close to a couple of them and took their advice in many situations. Eventually, I got my license, and I wanted to share flying with others. My logbook reminded me I flew my future wife, her kids, my brother, as my first few passengers. I learned all about the airports that had restaurants and other interesting places to visit and fly over. I've noted those places and places that weren't my favorite in the logbook. I joined an EAA chapter. When the EAA started the Young Eagles program, I was able to fly a couple of kids a year. It seemed like a noble cause, getting them familiar with aviation and to allow them to have a positive experience. I didn't think about them becoming pilots because of me. At least two of them have become pilots. One of them just soloed an Air Force T-6. At a Young Eagles chapter event, I was able to fly my mentor around. My old neighbor, who I had grown up next to, who I had wished I could get a ride with, was working as a volunteer ground crew. After the event, we took the plane I was using for a little fun flight. It was an honor. I was glad he was willing to ride with me. I let him fly most of the flight. I got to see him get some real enjoyment from it since he had quit flying a few years before. I did eventually build my own airplane. During building, I joined a flying club to keep currency and to minimize costs. I was offered many opportunities to fly other people who weren't familiar with aviation, some of my helpers and other acquaintances. A couple of them went on to become pilots, and others went on to build aircraft. When I was close to finishing my airplane, people offered to let me fly their aircraft so I could get the experience that I needed for insurance purposes. I logged the flights I made so that I could prove to the insurance company that I made those flights. I had many airplane celebrations. When I got my engine started, I invited a bunch of friends out to the airport for a small party. Many of them had never been close to a small airplane before. Those people I invited back and eventually took some of them flying. When I had my first flight, there were people who heard on the radio what was going on. They all greeted me when I got out to congratulate me. There were plenty of handshaking and discussions about that event. I need to thank a lot of people who have inspired, tolerated, and encouraged my engagement in aviation. I've been lucky to know so many great people that are willing to share. I hope I've put a dent in their efforts to offer me help and opportunities. I plan on keeping offering help and opportunities and taking whatever advice and opportunities anyone is willing to share. One of the women in our group who got to ride in the simulator said she had fun. She understands why I love flying. She could see the challenges and rewards pilots enjoy. I think we have another potential pilot given the proper nurturing. I did log the 20 minutes I was pilot in command of the 737-800 simulator. I didn't log it for time towards a rating, but for the memory.
All right. Hey, thanks for to Tom for that. That's a great story.
Oh, I like that. And you know, it's the old story. You just can't believe how many people one person influenced, and sometimes you never even know that you did influence them.
Yeah, yeah. So we have a couple more of these, but what we'll do is play one a week.
But we don't want to discourage everybody. Keep sending them in. They're fantastic.
Yeah, these are really great.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah. So we have two more in the can here. But, you know, send yours in. You know, make it, two, 3 minutes. It sounds like a short period of time, but it goes fast. So, you know, try to keep them kind of to that target. And just, you know, tell us, what was it that got you interested in aviation? What was it that led you to go for a pilot's license? Tell us your own stories. We heard from Seacar. He says, I just finished listening to episode 232 and 233. Want to bring up a point about the PED usage in planes. That's our conversation about personal electronic devices. Seacar says, one, I totally understand the safety aspect regarding the PEDs becoming objects that will fly around and hit other people in case of a crash, as they will not be safely secured. I think just for this, stowing the PEDs is a good idea. And then he says, number two, I know that all electronic devices that are sold in the U.S. have to be certified by the FCC. And in the EU, it's got its own CE system. He says if there are some rules or guidelines available from the FAA or the airframers, why can't the FCC, which is testing both the EMI and EMC specifications, just add these things to the list and certify them for use on aircraft? He says, going by this, the too many devices argument does not hold, as the FCC is already testing all consumer devices, and a few more tests would only increase the time a little, and maybe the cost a little too. He says, what do you think? That's kind of interesting. We said that, you know, the argument, one of the arguments is, in the past has been that, you know, with all the variety of devices out there, how can the FAA test for, or someone for, you know, all of those for interference on aircraft? But yeah, they're all being tested already.
Good point. You know, these common sense, are very, you know, smart.
Common sense. It'll never happen.
But it's a great idea. Of course, it hinges on the FAA or somebody being able to specify what the test is. And that might be the hard part. Bob Iverson wrote us. He says episode 234 was another great one. I've got comments on two parts of it. He says his personal experience concerning personal electronic devices on aircraft, in this case my Cessna Cardinal, is that I can occasionally hear some buzzing on the comm radio caused by someone's cell phone that was left on. He says, must be a passenger. I wouldn't do that. He says, my other direct experience was when I was on a CRJ. As we were about to push back from the gate, the captain called the flight attendant to say someone had their cell phone on, which they did. When we landed, I asked the captain how he knew. He said, because he could hear it on the comm radio. That's kind of interesting. So, I mean, we've all, I think, heard phones affect other equipment, make that kind of noise. Let's see. Bob says, my other comment is about, quote, our biggest carbon sin. He says, the thing that drives me nuts about articles like this is that they only tell half-truths. In this case, they try to scare us with the amount of CO2 emitted per passenger on a long flight. What they don't say is how much effect that has on global warming. Using the best data I can find, worldwide aviation emits 200 million tons of CO2 annually. That sounds like a lot, but the sensitivity of global temperature to CO2 is only about 1 picodegree centigrade per ton. He says that's 1/1,000,000 of 1/1,000,000. So all of the aviation causes the Earth's temperature to rise a whopping 0.0002°C per year. He says, I think we've got more important things to worry about.
However, we are a very visible form of pollution, even though we may be a small chunk of that pollution. Very much the way people don't worry about diesel cars, but boy, do they notice those 18-wheelers when they start up from a traffic light and blow all that black smoke out.
Yeah, so that's a good, interesting point. I mean, aviation is going to be a target, whether the contribution to warming or whatever is significant or not. Aviation is still going to be a target. We need to think of it in that way, because if we don't take care of ourselves, someone's going to do it for us, and we've seen how well that works.
Absolutely.
We heard from Gary. He's from Christchurch, New Zealand, which is what a beautiful place. I tell you, it was a long time ago that I was in Christchurch on a little business trip, but I would love to go back to New Zealand, especially Christchurch. Anyway, Gary says, just listened to Our Listeners Are the Stars, which was episode 234. He says, another great show that maintains your impossibly high standards. Wow. He says, I don't know how you manage and still have day jobs. Let me tell you, it's not easy.
It's easy. We don't have jobs anymore.
Well, yeah, if you're retired, huh? Are you retired, Rob, or are you just sort of semi-retired, or do you just consider yourself fully employed?
I consider myself overemployed and underrested.
Okay. Good answer. Anyway, Gary sent us a link to a YouTube video. It's called Life as an Airline Pilot.
Was that not the coolest damn video you ever saw?
Right, yeah.
I mean, I love that.
So describe that a little bit if you can.
Well, what I want to say to Gary is thank you, of course, for sending that. But Golf Charlie 232, the mystery pilot who produced that, has a YouTube channel that has some incredibly well-produced videos on it. And what it does is it takes you through probably a piece of a schedule. It looks like 3 or 4 days worth, perhaps 5 days worth of an airline pilot's life, from getting up early in the morning and flying the trips and looking at the amount of time they sit around doing nothing, waiting for something to happen, their free time, some of the places they get to see. What it's like when you always have to get up early every morning or go to bed late at night. And what I thought was interesting about it is it wasn't a, isn't this a terrible life or look how bad my life is. It was just simply a, hey, if you've wondered what it's like, here it is in video with some music. And I just thought it was so well done that if you wanted to be a pilot and you changed your mind after you saw this video, you need therapy. But then, of course, yeah. I have cards I can give people for my wife who will be happy to give them therapy. But it was a great video. I really did. And I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, it's good. And I don't know if you saw this, but after we posted that link on Twitter, Pat Flanagan tweeted back. He said, I would love to make awesome videos like this if it weren't for that pesky no electronic devices below 10,000 foot rule. That was clever.
Well, you know, see, I have to admit, I did kind of wonder about that. And it's all shot from the right seat, but we don't really know what airline this person works for or how it all came together, but I don't care because I just thought it was great.
It is. All right, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that. Yeah, we got a voicemail from Ian Kershaw, and this is on batteries and slide rules. Here's Ian.
Well, good morning, folks. It's Ian Kershaw on Thursday, the 14th of February. Happy Valentine's, everybody. Just listened to the show while I was traveling in on the train and not finished the program yet, but just thought I'd tease Rob a little bit. I always game for that. He mentioned, we're talking about the Dreamliner, the Duracell batteries being changed for copper tops. I think they're both Duracells. I think what he really meant was Energizer. And he really should know that because the Energizer just goes on and on and on. And then, of course, there's the slide rules. Yeah, I used one at school. But ironically, I also remember using log tables in a moth-eaten book that we had to look things up. That was even more painful than the slide rule. Anyway, just listening to Stephen Grant and looking forward to Peter and the rest of the show. Take care, guys. All the best. Bye now.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
You know, he just reminded me of one of the worst experiences of my life. Thank you for that, Ian. Log tables.
I remember those, too.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that used to be a business, is printing books. There were nothing but tables like that. Incredible.
I hated that.
You've come so far.
I hated that. Well, anyway, thank you for that wonderful point about Duracells and copper tops and, well, whatever. Yeah. I don't know what I meant. I just meant change the batteries out.
All right. And we heard from William. He says, William says, while listening to the segment on carbon and comments about China and its horrid pollution, I was struck by an apparent lack of historical perspective. He says, the, quote, industrial revolution of Europe, the North Americas, and its aftermath has been putting chemical pollution into the atmosphere for a century. I would suggest that a listening to the BBC Witness podcast of Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013, available on iTunes, titled The Keeling Curve. It says, 55 years ago, Charles Keeling began the detailed and long-term measurement of CO2 in the atmosphere. It would cause one to consider, in a crude term, national fairness. A question could be posed as follows. In fairness, should the industrialized nations halt industry and any form of atmospheric carbon and other chemical aerosol outputs to allow the countries not yet fully industrialized to, quote, catch up so the Earth pollution curve would be flattened? He says, pulpit preaching without a full understanding of the text is perhaps a bad podcast methodology. Let's see. There's another topic he mentions, but before we go on to that. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. It's easy to criticize others sometimes for things that, you know, we ourselves have done in the past. And I'm talking about things that the Industrial Revolution brought along with it. I mean, there was some pretty ugly pollution associated with that at the time, maybe less so now. But, you know, other countries are going down that same path, and do the, you know, industrialized nations have kind of a right to, you know, change the rules, as it were, for those who are trying to catch up? So it's an interesting kind of philosophical question.
Oh, my God. Next thing you know, we're going to be talking about politics.
I know.
Oh, wait. Sorry.
Where's David? Here we go.
Was a bit taken back by this. It was a really, really good point, and that's why I'm keeping my mouth shut, because I actually felt like there's a lot of merit to
What William is saying.
Not being hypocrites.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, and we traded some emails with William on that we won't drag everybody through, but yeah, it kind of revolves around that. He goes on to say, an aside is my memory.
I don't think being a hypocrite is such a big deal. I don't dislike you guys more because you're hypocrites. I mean,
okay.
I don't dislike you more.
Yeah. Did you like that one?
No, that was good. I had to think about that. So back to William. He says, an aside is my memory of my first flight. It was during April of 1963, and I was on a Boeing 720 of Aer Lingus during a transatlantic flight. He says, an hour or so out of Shannon, while having a meal, one of the onboard starboard engines started emitting flames. Well, that's never a good thing. Moments later, the crew announced that another engine was having problems, and we were returning to Erie. The following day, we boarded another flight to New York. The flight
not Erie. I think it's probably Air.
Air?
That's what he's probably talking about. Well, they took off from Dublin, didn't he? Or did they take off from Shannon?
Out of Shannon.
Yeah, well, that's the Air is sort of the Irish way of describing the island.
Oh, it is really?
Air.
Oh, E-R-I-E,
It's just like it's spelled just like Erie, though, but it's
all Air. Right. Well, I learned something this episode.
There you go.
He says, the following day, we boarded another flight to New York. That flight had many empty seats, but I do remember that the passengers were praying as if in church. So, yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it's a big deal when you lose one engine, lose two, and even I start to get a little bit nervous.
I have a friend that flies 747s for a large international carrier that's based near where I am here in Chicago.
So oh, yes.
Carrier, of course, will go unnamed. And this person is about to make a change from the 747s because they're getting rid of them at O'Hare, and they're only going to be based in San Francisco. So the person either has to change airplanes or they're going to have to commute to work. And this person said they were going to the 777 because they didn't want to have to do all the commuting, and they just couldn't imagine flying across the North Atlantic or the Pacific in that light twin.
The light twin.
So, yeah, a light funny. Twin? Yeah, so I guess it's all a matter of perspective.
Right. All right. Our final email comes from Tim. He writes, I've just listened to Peter's piece on the TU-204 accident, and it appeared to me that a part of what he implied from the report was that the thrust reversers didn't operate, possibly because the landing gear didn't show enough compression on both sides to indicate it was on the ground. So the question I thought he asked that I don't think was answered is that a feature of the reverse thrusters on any other or possibly all modern planes? It sounds like a bit of a catch-22 in this situation. If it's true that they couldn't slow down so that they couldn't get the wheels on the ground so they couldn't slow down. as a possible extended discussion, what are the systems controlling when and how reverse thrust can be applied in modern airplanes? As a possible extended discussion, what are the systems controlling when and how reverse thrust can be applied in modern airplanes? And if it has a problem, how do you stop? I didn't know this about, I mean, it makes sense. I think obviously, at least obviously to me, you don't want the thrust reversers to engage if you're not kind of firmly on the ground. And I don't know. Do you know, Rob, is compression of the landing gear the way you indicate to the thrust reversers that you are firmly on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. It's called a squat switch, and most large aircraft have more than one. And they're designed to ensure that the airplane is firmly planted on the runway before you can either pull the board or the speed brakes or the thrust reversers. The speed brakes usually will come out automatically. The thrust reversers need to be manually engaged. But again, the reason they don't allow you to use the speed brakes or the thrust reversers unless both wheels are planted on the ground. A couple of things, actually. One is that if you did pull the reversers out somehow, you could get the airplane to pivot around one wheel if the thrust did not come out evenly. And, of course, they don't want that. And that, of course, isn't slowing the airplane down anyway. But the other issue, too, is that until both mains are planted on the ground, and the reverser throttles are pulled back. In fact, I put a link in the email that we sent back today, and people can see what those thrust reverser throttles look like. They sit sort of on top of the regular throttles in a jet airplane. But the other problem is that the airplane wants to make sure that the pilots haven't decided at the last minute that maybe this is going to be a botched landing, and we better pour the coals to it and go around. And so it's trying to give the crew the benefit of the doubt. But on that Russian airplane that we were talking about, sounds to me like something went really, really wrong. It sounds like the engine spooled up, which is okay, but the clamshells that direct the thrust forward didn't come out, and that's not okay. And so they had kind of the worst of both worlds, I think. But in answer to the question, which I did cleverly avoid on both occasions, it's not supposed to work like that. That is pretty much standard all over the world.
Huh. Okay, interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. All right, well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Henry Hartevelt, now of Hudson Crossing. You can find that website at www.hudsoncrossing.com. We always love to have Henry on the show. It's been kind of a while, and we really want to thank him for last minute sort of fitting him in around his business commitments. And I'd like to thank Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And Peter Johnson, who you can find on Twitter as Nascot Hornet. Look for him on Facebook as XTP Media. And also you can check out his podcast, Aviation Extended, at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. And let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. So let's see. Who do we start with first? Well, I don't remember the order, so we'll go with Rob Mark. Rob, where do people find you online?
Oh, they find us at JetWine on Twitter. They find us at JetWine on Facebook. They find me at JetWine.com on the blog, where Scott and I are always trying to make interesting content for people. And I don't know, probably all kinds of other places, some of which we're not even sure of until the airplane touches down.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
Well, after tonight's rant, I will be dodging black helicopters.
Or something.
You can find me on whatjustflewby.com. You can find me lurking on the Facebook page, which reminds me, I did not forget we are doing Snoopy versus the Red Baron, and I promise we will do triplanes and camels next week. And for those who want to vote, you can send me a tweet on Twitter. Just put Dogfight of the Week, or they can go on Facebook and vote there. Vote early and vote often.
Are we going to talk about the history segment a little bit? Because you did a poll up there.
Oh, my beloved co-host Rob had commented that he finally noticed after 6 months that we hadn't been doing a history.
Oh, you had to say that. Just had to say that. You just can't let it go, can you? All right, go ahead, David.
And there's a general consensus that people seem to miss the history segments on top of just the airplanes. So I think what we're going to do is maybe a 50-50 alternate weeks, or maybe we'll play it by ear. We'll do our dogfight next week, and then maybe we'll do some history for March and then go back to a dogfight. So I don't want to lose the it is fun watching the Facebook dogfights go on about what airplane to do and this comments, but a lot of you did say you miss the basic history. So we've gone from one side of the pendulum to the other. Now we're going to see if we can find a happy medium, and hopefully I won't be writing for 5 or 6 hours a week. But if it makes you happy, it's worth it.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus as Max Flight. Also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. And, I meant to mention this last time. I was also on a guest on the School of Podcasting podcast. So if you're interested in podcasting and or want to listen to me on that show, just go over to schoolofpodcasting.com, and it's a couple of episodes ago. You can find me there. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. I have links to all the sites that we mentioned. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com. Hello to all of our Stitcher listeners. From Stitcher, you can stream us to your mobile phone or other device. If you'd like to send us email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we also have a listener line. You can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet has that number for us.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
It's fun to be able to talk about this with people and not have someone look at you like you have three heads.
There's Rob on video.
On video, nonetheless.
What kind of head is that, Rob?
Go back to whatever.
Well, I guess I'd probably rather choose what Max thinks rather than your Mickey Mouse. I'm sorry, your professional audio equipment there too. I don't know.
Wait a minute, who's hosting the call? Can I hit a jack?
I don't know. Yeah,
so Rob, yeah, you sounded better when Henry was on.
Hello, is this the Airplane Geek Show?
Yeah, that's perfect, Rob.
I have a long distance call for you.
Oh great, a singing telegram from a jackass.
And you know what's really bad is that, you know, you guys sound like you're.
Also, it should actually go into effect. I can't even say it. I get so angry about it.
And if it has been a, if it has a, and if it, and if it has a problem. Okay. Oh my gosh.
Tell when we're getting to the end of the show.
I know. Max is getting
How
tired.
How do you stop? Period.
How do you stop? Period.